This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Today's show is How to Live, a search for wisdom from old people. Age brings the opportunity for wisdom, but doesn't automatically bring wisdom. Henry Alford, a pundit and humorist who writes for the New York Times, Vanity Fair, and The New Yorker, set out to seek the wisdom of older people, or as he puts it, while they're still on this earth. The result was his newest book, How to Live. Today he shares the insight, wit, and wisdom from his quest. Henry, welcome.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
I did an Amazon search for Dummies books on wisdom, and sure enough, there's a Helpful Hits, Tips, and Practical Wisdom for Dummies, a Complete Idiot Guide to Toltec Wisdom, and a Complete Idiot Guide to Celtic Wisdom. So I'm going to subtitle your book, How to Live, a Guide for People Who Aren't Dummies and Complete Idiots.
Or Toltec. Well, thank you for that.
I thought a good example of your wit was you described how you got into a taxi cab and the cabbie went on and on about how to solve the Israeli-Arab conflict and Iran and Iraq and what the president should do and various celebrities should do, and you concluded
that it's a shame that all the people who really know how to run the world are all busy cutting hair or driving cabs.
I love it.
Well, thank you.
You set out on a quest to find what older people could teach us about wisdom, and we know how a professor would proceed going through all the academic research and statistics, and how a theologian would proceed. How did you go about doing this?
I thought that I would do it by simply talking to people who have led really interesting lives. That's always my favorite kind of storytelling, is biography. So I figured if you talk to people who have had lives where there was a lot of adversity or where there was a lot of tumult, or if you talk to people who have had a lot of achievements of a kind that bespeak wisdom, then you're very likely to unearth some interesting treasures.
So we're studying the outliers, which is going to be far more interesting than studying Iowa Gothic.
Exactly.
One of the first persons that you talked about is somebody that I just absolutely love, Phyllis Diller. What did you get from Phyllis Diller?
Oh, Phyllis Diller is my childhood icon. Well, my idea there was, obviously, she was one of the very few women in the field of stand-up comedy. So added to the sort of nightmarish life that is being a performer who's always on the road, she sort of had that double whammy. So I figured she would have a lot to say about how to deal with those kinds of obstacles. And indeed, she was absolutely hilarious. She is not one of the longer interviews in the book simply because the way she deals with it is through positive thinking. I would never denigrate positive thinking, but it's simply, it's a tough one to write about because her form of positive thinking verges on the dogmatic.
And she has such a high energy level and even speaks real quickly, or is that just when she's on stage?
No. She totally speaks quickly. And, you know, she holds a Guinness World Record for saying the most number of jokes in a minute. And that was something that I brought up, was the way that she got through obstacles in life was she never looked back, she never looked forward, she was always present in the moment and just always had a good, you know, good positive thinking. And I said, well, surely some obstacles have come up, like what would you do if people heckled you? And she said, you couldn't heckle me, you'd need to make an appointment to heckle me.
So it wasn't just being very positive. We have all these philosophers that talk about living in the moment. She was just naturally doing it before people were talking about it.
She was, indeed. Yeah, she even has this image of wearing a white cape that sort of protects her from any sort of alien negative forces. So, yeah, she was doing it way back when.
Now, does she try to teach others to do this, or she just does it?
No, I don't think she proselytizes, but as I say, it was a tricky one for me to write about, so I just included it as a short bit in the book, simply because there are not a lot of shades of gray there. You get a better interview, like with someone like Ram Dass, the spiritual leader, who's someone, you know, there's an old F. Scott Fitzgerald quote about the mark of a great mind is someone who can hold two opposing ideas in their mind at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And Ram Dass certainly falls into that category. Whereas someone like Phyllis Diller, who's such a positive thinker, it's almost like she's tuning out any possible negative force. And I think that's a reflection of her specific profession. To get on a stage and be funny and put yourself at the mercy of total strangers, many who have been drinking heavily, that's probably, outside of brain surgery, that's probably one of the more challenging professions you could do.
It's certainly a brutal profession, but I bet that she sees hecklers as just more material to work with, and when she gets hecklers, her act gets even better.
Right, it's true.
Most of these people, you flew to wherever they were and visited them.
Yep.
And in the case of Ram Dass, you hopped planes to Hawaii, not even sure that he would actually be there when you showed up.
Yeah, that one was sort of weird because he agreed to the interview by email, and then when I said, great, we figured it, we'd hammered out a date, still by email. And then when we talked on the phone briefly before I left, his voice was so halting. And, you know, he's interesting because he had a stroke in his late 60s and has pretty severe aphasia. Moreover, half of his body is paralyzed. He's confined to a wheelchair. He requires round-the-clock medical attention or medical aids. He cannot drive for himself. And I didn't realize when I set up the interview that his aphasia was that bad. So, yeah, then he kind of waffled, and I decided I'm just going to get on the plane anyway. And I got to Maui, and I think he's one of the best interviews in the book. He's just so genuine. And with someone who's a Buddhist, again, he's talking about thousands of years of tradition, and it's something, and Buddhism is something which in other hands can seem dogmatic, but he is so open to any of your skeptical questions or any doubt that it never seems like he's programmed. He really entertains all possibilities.
Of course, this wasn't as big a risk as we're letting on, because the worst thing that could have happened was you'd have a business write-off for a trip to Maui.
Oh, my God. The tyranny of the gilded cage.
Let's back up for just a moment, and could you give a brief background on who Ram Dass is for people who aren't familiar with him?
Sure. Ram Dass is primarily known as the author of a book called Be Here Now, which was written in the 60s and at the time outsold, it was the third best-selling book of all time. He's a Buddhist teacher who has a very interesting past because he started out as an academic. He was a professor at Harvard, and he befriended Timothy Leary, and they started experimenting with LSD, and Ram Dass was actually giving it out to his graduate students. Got booted out of Harvard, went to India, found a guru, became enlightened, and then wrote Be Here Now, which was this huge runaway global success. And since then has been a spiritual leader, and he's very active in the hospice movement. Yeah, so that's essentially who he is.
One of the things that amazed you was that he eventually came to see his stroke as a good thing and part of his spiritual evolution.
Yeah, it's kind of freaky because, again, he is half, you know, half his body is paralyzed, and he talks about this stroke as if it were a gift from his guru. He says that the pauses in his conversation that his aphasia give him, that those actually work as a teaching tool for him, because they force the person he's talking to, or his students, if you will, they force them to fill in the blanks in the conversation, or to answer their own question.
What, were you just modeling that with a pause?
Yeah, exactly. I was hoping someone would fill that in.
So it was the pausing that he saw was the biggest blessing that came out of the aphasia and the stroke.
He thinks that's a blessing. He thinks the fact that he's physically challenged has helped him to really appreciate the things that he can do, and he thinks that his wheelchair, he has a whole sort of little riff in one of his books about how wheelchairs are traditionally they're symbols of power, like leaders being carried in on palanquins or on litters, that, yeah, it's almost like a ceremonial vehicle.
One of the things that amazed me was, and I forget the detail that brought it up, but he said, well, my Maharishi made me that way. In Western thought, we would think of, I taught myself to be more evolved, or I tuned into infinite knowledge, or tuned into God's purpose. But he almost made it sound like a drill instructor had made a Marine out of him.
Yeah, it's true. And he would concede that in order to let that drill instructor drill it into him, that Ram Dass had to make himself available to it. But no, Buddhism is a culture that exalts yogis and exalts teachers. So, you know, I think it'd be too far to say it's an aristocracy, but it honors people who are particularly enlightened.
And he's an extremely humble person himself.
Oh, he's humble and he's hilarious. I mean, he's almost like this, like a Jewish comic. Yeah, he's just full of funny, self-deprecating lines. And I think that's what has made Buddhism and Ram Dass's whole, what might strike them as sort of ooey-wooey or touchy-feely, it makes it totally palatable in his hands, because he's just a funny guy next door.
One of the things that amazed you was that he decided not to go to his brother's funeral, which you saw as good and bad.
Yeah, I was kind of amazed that he let me see that he knew that my tape recorder was rolling and let me in on that. The thing is Ram Dass doesn't like to fly anymore, so he's pretty much on Maui, the island of Maui, for the rest of his life. And yes, just prior to my visiting him, his brother had just died, and I said, well, you'll be going to his funeral, of course, won't you? And he said, no, I talked to my brother, and then he motioned skyward. And yeah, that's kind of a controversial take, I think.
So very much a different drummer.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm someone who has always lived under the impression that I will go to even my enemy's funeral, that my friends and I will all go to each other's funerals. So the fact that he is not going to his own brother's funeral, yeah, I don't know. That's, as I say, I really admired Ram Dass for being that honest, that he that he copped to that.
I wonder if he would have traveled to his Maharishi's funeral.
Yeah, it's true. I should have asked. Why weren't you there? You should have been there with me to ask the question.
You mentioned that he's done a lot of work with hospice. What exactly has he done with or for hospice?
He does a lot of counseling of people. I mean, in addition to speaking on behalf of hospices and helping to, you know, get money for the hospice movement, he does a lot of one-on-one counseling, where he will go to hospices and talk to, either the grieving family or to the person, the patient himself.
So even now, does he leave his home to visit hospices in Hawaii?
I believe he's still doing it. Yeah, I'm not positive, but yeah, I believe he is still doing it on the island of Maui.
One of the fascinating things you talked about was an exercise where a woman with cancer said, if you were visiting me, what would you be thinking? Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah, that was from a workshop that Ram Dass did, and they wrote down on a blackboard what everyone in the audience would be thinking about, and the answers were all, I feel guilty for not coming to the hospital enough, I feel awful that I'm in great health and you're dying, I feel bad about that summer where we rented the summer house and it didn't work out. All of these kind of negative emotions, and yeah, all to say that someone who's dying, the hardest thing for family members and loved ones to understand is that it's not about them, it's not about themselves, it's about the person who is dying. And it's very hard for people who go into hospital rooms or hospices to put their own preoccupations aside and just focus on the person in the bed.
That was worth the whole book, because it's one of those, duh. You know, it's so obvious, but it's one that everybody falls into.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've got to tell us, too, about the chocolates.
The chocolates. Simply that when I visited Ram Dass, he had just minutes earlier been talking to a documentary film crew who had left him a tin of very exciting little truffle-y chocolates. And Ram Dass sort of extended them with his one good arm to offer me one. And then when I kind of reached out with my claw-like hand, he yanked it back and he said, I'm not offering all of them to you.
You think of him as so ethereal and he wants those chocolates.
No, exactly. No, and that's what's another part of him that's so heartening besides the self-deprecating humor is he's really a man of great animal appetites. He's always writing about how he can no longer drive his red sports car or this relishing the chocolates, or it's very clear that he's not one of these breezy ascetics that he doesn't have all these monk-like qualities, but he's this red-blooded guy like you or me.
Oh, indeed. When he asked you where you live and you told him, he said, oh, yeah, I used to cruise that neighborhood.
Yeah, that was another revelation, because he does not typically talk about his homosexuality. So, and that, I think that's a product of age. Again, that I think so often older folks just get sick of playing games, as many closeted or overly deferential gay folks do, that just at a certain point they say, look, I am not going to keep pretending that I'm straight. I'm just going to tell the world who I am.
Wisdom can have so many different definitions or takes, and maybe we can get to that later, but this one that we kind of stumbled on is I see so many people in their 80s and 90s that I just don't have time for that crap anymore. I tell it like it is. And you even see it on things like Johnny Carson or Jay Leno. They'll get some woman who just whatever her take is on something, you know, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard of.
Exactly. It almost, it verges on a kind of Tourette's almost.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's true. I think that we see these wonderful changes in older folks for a variety of reasons. And yes, this is definitely one scenario where people are just fed up with
the games and the bullshit.
Yeah, and they're just going to blurt out what's on their mind. That's one version of it. Another version of it is really surprised in talking to all these folks how many of them point blank just said to me, I don't have that much time left. So there's this other version where people are, you know, kind of conscious of the tick, 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 tick of the clock. And then, yeah, I think there are other ones as well.
Well, and another thing that feeds it is there's nothing to fear. Nobody's going to fire them.
Exactly.
We'll get back to Henry Alford in just a moment. Historically, psychologists have focused on fixing what's wrong with you. From almost 40 years of clinical experience, frankly, I'm very good at that, but what I enjoy doing most is helping successful people be even more successful and even healthier. Success in life calls for being crystal clear about who you are, what you want, and how you're going to achieve it. Just as athletes use coaches to achieve their full potential, my coaching can help you achieve your full potential. If you have goals and you're having difficulty achieving them, or you're interested in life makeover coaching to develop a comprehensive plan for your life, give me a call and I'll see if I can help you. For therapy issues, I meet with people in person. Coaching, however, works very well by phone. The phone number is on all my websites, and further information about my coaching is at drbricke.com, drbricke.com, or you can go to notaging.com, notaging.com. And now back to Henry Alford. You must have one of the most interesting Rolodexes in the world. I mean, Phyllis Diller, Ram Dass, and on with many famous authors. Let's take a break now. We're talking with Henry Alford, who has started off writing for Spy magazine and later and currently New York Times, Vanity Fair, The New Yorker. And your current delightful book is How to Live, A Search for Wisdom from Old People While They're Still on This Earth. And your website is henryalford.com. That's henryalford.com. Where it's both a website and a blog, and you list yourself as humorist, journalist, and guy of letters. Anything else you want to tell? Oh, and you've got two previous books, Municipal Bondage, which is a collection of stories, and Big Kiss, which was a Thurber Prize winner about becoming an actor. Anything else you'd like to tell us about what you've been up to?
Mostly recently, I've been writing for the New York Times. I had a story about 6 weeks ago about eating goat meat. It's very trendy now to eat goat. So that was something in the dining section. And then I just handed in a story about, also for the dining section of the Times, about leftovers. Because I realize that with this economic recession on, people are thinking about leftovers.
Back to some of the people you've interviewed, going from one extreme to the other, with from the mystic to the traditional research, Dr. Robert Sternberg, a past president of the American Psychological Association, and balance theory. Was he one of the people that impressed you quite a bit?
He was. That's not one of the full-length interviews, but I did feel like I should talk to someone else who had grappled with this incredibly huge and confusing question of what is wisdom. And his, basically what he really brings to the equation in terms of historical ideas about what is wisdom is this idea of balance, as you say, that a wise person is someone who can bring a quality of, who knows that actions bear consequences, so that when we make decisions, that we know that there'll be reverberations. And that's something that, obviously, as children, we definitely don't have. As teenagers, we don't have. As adults, we're grappling with it. You know, we're learning that if I marry this person, here's what's likely to happen. Or if I buy this kind of car, here's what's likely to happen. But I think it takes our whole adulthood up until we're in our 60s or 70s or 80s to finally see some of the patterns there and say, oh, well, here is what happens when I marry that person or buy that car.
Mm-hmm. So probably the most profound part of it was balancing short-term consequences and long-term consequences. Maybe heavy drinkers in our 20s and 30s and start wising up and start eating better. And it's actually kind of a good fit because our bodies are more forgiving when we're younger.
Thank God.
And he also talked about being able to appreciate other people's perspectives better.
Yes.
As you said, the idea of seeing the patterns, what's worked, what hasn't worked, and being a little less likely to repeat the mistakes.
Right.
Who else impressed you the most?
The person who impressed me the most was a guy named Salama Kalathay, who is a Moken fisherman. The Moken are a tribe in the Southeast Indies, and it's a group of folks who learn to swim before they walk and who can hold their breath underwater twice as long as most humans can. They're nomadic fishermen. So possessing what's almost like a form of animal intelligence, this one guy, on the morning of the tsunami in 2003, he noticed all these harbingers of doom in nature. He noticed how the tide receded especially quickly. He noticed how the buzzing of the cicadas on the shore, how it dimmed in a certain way. And it struck, he knew that something was afoot, and he told his fellow tribe members to climb a local mountain. And in so doing, he saved literally thousands of lives. Like more than 2,000 lives. You know, wisdom is not usually that dramatic or that sexy. Typically, wisdom is, it's a tiny epiphany that one person has while sitting in a log cabin in the middle of Vermont or what have you. But, you know, typically it's something internal and very personal. So the fact that his very personal internal epiphany could be turned into this incredible life-saving measure, yeah, that's very exciting stuff.
And I'm guessing that he just saw it as, well, wouldn't anybody have that kind of insight?
I bet. I bet he did.
Why did you choose Sylvia Miles?
Sylvia Miles, the two-time Oscar-nominated actress, Midnight Cowboy is the role that most people know her from. Well, the reason why I picked her specifically was there's a famous incident where she received a very nasty, very ad hominem review from the world's meanest critic, who is John Simon, who used to write for New York Magazine. And Sylvia decided that on behalf of her fellow thespians, she decided to act on her anger, her pique. She found out about a party that this critic was going to be at. She went to the party. She went up to the buffet table. She took a plate. She piled some cottage cheese and a pork chop and some salami and some cucumber slices and some pancetta and some salad on it. Then she walked up to the critic and she dumped the food on his head. And I asked her about it and I said, what about that time? And she said, look, I know that I lost work as a result of that. People thought I was crazy, but I would do it again in a heartbeat.
Because?
Because it was what she needed to do. It was how she knew that in so doing that thousands would silently be cheering her on, that this guy had been doling out these nasty, vituperative theater reviews for all these years, and someone needed to give him a dose of his medicine.
So it was the equivalent of the Iraqis throwing the shoe at President Bush.
If you will.
Well, she is a person who has a sense of theater or theater of the absurd in the parties she goes to. I mean, she goes to these parties to make a splash every time she can, and is that wisdom? Or?
Well, I don't know if that's wisdom. I think she's very savvy, but it's an interesting question because it's something that I grappled with as I was coming to a definition of wisdom, is that to my mind, the person who acts out of self-preservation or the person who looks out for number one, that's not really wisdom. To me, that person's not wise, that person is savvy. So I don't think that aspect of Sylvia is particularly, I mean, it's wise in a, you know, sort of a, she has practical good sense. Yes, the fact that she goes to a lot of parties, she gets photographed, that, yes, that does help her business as an actress. But no, I think her wisdom is more, well, sometimes it's very verbal. Like she said to me at one point, the establishment selects the avant-garde,
mm-hmm.
which is a pretty interesting statement, I think. And that's part of her, so she has this kind of aphoristic thing going on. And I think, yeah, she does have this wisdom in terms of she knows exactly what she's doing. She's not kidding herself when she realizes that dumping a plate of food on someone's head, that probably lost her as much work as it gained her sympathy.
So going to the parties and being the life of the party, that's social intelligence, but when she dumped the food on the critic's head, that was serving a, in her mind and many other people's minds, a larger common good of justice and giving some feedback to a critic who really needed some humbling. So that would be seen as wisdom then.
I think so. Yeah, arguably it would. And I think just her knowing what the repercussions of that act of the food dumping were, yeah, that's a form of wisdom. Yes.
Particularly the way she thought it out in advance, planned so that there wouldn't be photographers there, and
right. Yeah, she was not doing that to get attention, and she was not doing it to get publicity.
One of the people that you considered was Shirley Chisholm, and I thought, oh, I haven't heard that name in ages. What a fantastic woman. How did we lose her as a role model?
I know. It's so sad. And, there's a fabulous, much longer version of that anecdote that I tell in the book of when she was in Congress and there was a racist, one of her racist colleagues would cough at Shirley Chisholm whenever she entered chambers. And finally someone pointed out to her, Shirley, that man's not coughing, he's actually spitting in his handkerchief, as if spitting at you. And she enacts a little revenge that is Sylvia Miles-like. And, yeah, there was actually a much longer version of that story, but couldn't get the permission for it. But no, yeah, absolutely. She's a terrific role model, and one who there was a very good documentary about her about 3 years ago. But other than that, yeah, one doesn't hear her name spoken a lot. And I think that ours is a culture that doesn't have a huge number of black female role models. So it would be great to have her around.
What is she doing now, or is she deceased?
She's deceased.
Sociologist Setsuko Nishi, why did you pick him, and what did he teach you?
Setsuko Nishi is actually a woman who told me about being in an internment camp during the war. And that was sort of a fascinating interview because we had lunch and she actually related a story which she had only told one other person before. And it was it's a very, very moving story. And yeah, I reached out to her because I realized early on in the process that one of the avenues down which wisdom often travels is the lives of people who have faced some kind of discrimination or adversity. So I figured someone who served time in an internment camp has definitely, that they faced something that those of us who've not been in that situation can definitely learn from. I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know before I talked to her that those folks who were put in internment camps, you know, that they weren't, you know, there was no legal
restitution.
Well, yes, that there was no restitution, but there was no, you know, no charges were made on them. They were simply rounded up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a chapter of our history that hasn't gotten much play at all. I had never heard about the fact that FDR, who of course was just an amazing leader and president, but that when those folks came out of the camps, that he tried to keep them from grouping, from, you know, all getting together in certain towns, that he wanted them spread out across the country so that they couldn't rally their strength.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I think people can easily appreciate how adversity can build character and build wisdom. What fascinated me with people like this is, on the one hand, we have somebody like Ram Dass, who's enormously flexible. Here we have someone who was a crusader for civil rights, particularly Asian and Japanese-American civil rights, and it becomes fairly single-minded, and the strong advocacy posture that is no longer that flexible, seeing all the perspectives, it's more for the cause. What do you make of that in relation to wisdom?
Well, it is really interesting, yes, that some people's wisdom causes them to become these very accepting Buddha-like entities. And as you say, in other cases, it just lights a fire and gets them out the door. I just think that's a reflection of those individuals, that the wisdom can work in different ways in different people. I was sort of fascinated by the idea that so many of those crusader types in my book are women, and I kind of loved that, like Granny D, who walked across the country at age 89 in support of campaign finance reform.
Which she got,
yeah, the best of all. And it occurs to me that old age can be a particularly fabulous time for women, that so many of these ladies in their 80s or even 70s and up, that they had developed lives by the time that feminism came round, so that they didn't necessarily enjoy the benefits of it as much as younger women did. So I think that often in their cases, that, you know, this late in life wisdom that they get, that suddenly it's, you know, it's like this dose of girl power, and and I think it does turn them into these terrific crusaders.
And I think the male archetype would probably be Ralph Nader. I mean, the guy doesn't change. He's had so much adversity where initially in the GM campaigns with Corvair. They did everything they could to smear him and everything, and he, like the Energizer Bunny, just keeps going and going and sticking to his cause.
It's true.
One of the fascinating things you did was every few chapters you'd weave in what was happening with your mother and the wisdom that was coming out of that.
Yeah. Oof, that was a curveball. If ever there was a curveball. Early on in the process, I decided I should interview my mom and stepfather because they're the older folks I know the best. And my stepfather was so dark in his interview that I actually asked him, you're not going to harm yourself, are you? And he said, no, I would never do that to my children. And the next night, like not even 24 hours later, he overdosed. He did not kill himself, but he had to be rushed to the emergency room. And my mom, who had been dealing with his substance abuse problems for, most of the 31 years that she had been with him, finally, at the age of 79, said, "Hey, I'm so sorry, but I can't do this anymore." And she divorced him and sold him her house and moved 500 miles away to North Carolina, to Durham, North Carolina, to live near my sister. So we keep coming back to my mother's story amidst all these other interviews.
So you saw her as extremely wise for having the, among other things, the guts to leave him when there was this potential emotional blackmail hanging over them that if he had killed himself a week later, she might have blamed herself.
Yeah,
exactly. If only I'd stayed with him.
Right. No, and again, I think this goes back to this dose of girl power, if you will, this kind of late-in-life feminism. My mom would not have left him, I don't think, if this had happened when she was in her 50s. I think she would have hung in there, but I think that she was at a point in her life where she just saw things differently, and it was time for her to break out on her own.
So this was a wisdom that was accumulating over the years, or more just having the gumption and the last straw of I can't do this anymore?
I think it was a little bit of both, to tell you the truth. What people respond to in that story, interestingly, particularly book groups who read the book, mm-hmm. respond to my mother's story because, well, it's interesting because wisdom is so often a you had to be there kind of thing. It's very hard to quantify wisdom sometimes, but often if you just see it played out, you have just sort of a visceral, intuitive idea of, oh, that person did the right thing, or, oh, I know what I would do, or, oh, I know exactly how to proceed. And I think in the chapters about my mother in the book, because it's all written sort of in the you are there type journalism, where it's just you're getting here's what she did, here, she called her lawyer, she did this, that in a weird way it's almost a better capturing of wisdom because you're just getting the blow by blow and you as the reader are forming your own perception. Whereas when I go talk to Ram Dass, I as author am really pointing it out to you and saying, this is wise, and here's when he talks about his brother, and that's not wise, and here's this part.
And then when you look at it from a distance, it's like looking at a work of art. Some of them you look at and you say, it works, and others you look and you say, oh. Nice try.
Exactly.
So what kind of conclusions did you end up with what wisdom is and how we might become more wise?
Well, in the end, instead of giving you a definition of wisdom, which I think is really tricky. You know, I think the closest anyone in the book comes to sort of distilling it is the playwright Edward Albee, who says to me, wisdom is knowing what to overlook. But I, as author, never flat out say, wisdom is X. Instead, I talk about five different traits that I think, or elements that are part of wisdom. Reciprocity, non-attachment, doubt, discretion, working for the social good. So, yeah, I thought it was more profitable to do that. And in the end, I think the takeaway for me on this whole book is the power of biography, the idea that by reading other people's stories, by learning about other people's lives, be they a woman who lost her home and husband in Hurricane Katrina, who's one of the characters, or be it Phyllis Diller, or be it Edward Albee, that when we read these people's lives and see how they very specifically dealt with each obstacle, each wrinkle on the map, each little divagation from you know, what they thought life, what their lives would be like, I think that we are buoyed up either with humility or with hope. It can work either way, but it's almost like a form of, it's almost a form of, you know, I tend to shy away from the word self-help, but I think that biography can work on that same level, that it can fire all those same nerve endings.
Oh, our minds are just programmed for stories. And you talk with professional speakers and they'll say, I can give them the greatest content in the world, and an hour later, all they're going to remember is the stories.
Exactly. It's true, because that's how we view life. Is, yeah, we don't, you know, don't give me a lot of abstract concepts. Tell me a story.
You are a marvelous storyteller, and I love How to Live, A Search for Wisdom from Old People While They're Still Around on This Earth. We're talking with Henry Alford, who also wrote Municipal Bondage, Big Kiss, and writes for New York Times, Vanity Fair, The New Yorker. And his blog is at henryalford.com. That's henryalford.com. So that's the way to get your latest take on what's happening in the world. Henry, anything else you want to add?
I think I just want to thank you so much for having me. This has been such a lovely conversation.
Well, it's an absolute delight, and I'm honored to be in your Rolodex now.
And vice versa.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Michael.
Bye now. Commentary. When it comes to interviewing and writing, frankly, I'm more used to the left-brain approach of talking about data and clinical experience. But from doing psychotherapy, life coaching, and public speaking, I'm also keenly aware of the power of stories. Exploring stories and biographies with Henry Alford is a refreshing shift to the right brain and exploring wisdom. Indeed, wisdom is such a difficult concept to define that it is especially well-suited to narrative examples. At first, I was feeling a little envious of Henry as he gets to interview experts on wisdom. Then I realized that interviewing experts is exactly what I do every 2 weeks on Ageless Lifestyles. The principal difference is that Henry Alford interviews them in person, and I interview them by phone. So what did we learn about wisdom? Perhaps it's like good art. You know it when you see it. Certainly, Henry provided us with wonderful examples of wise people. Various definitions of wisdom include a mix of erudition, judgment, making the best choices, cleverness, and spiritual wisdom. A classic example is King Solomon smoking out the real mother by ruling a disputed baby should be cut in half. Another classic example of wisdom is when a Gentile told Hillel that he would convert to Judaism if he could explain the Torah by standing on one foot. Hillel replied, "That which is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. That is the whole of the Torah. The rest is commentary." In our interview, Henry Alford zipped through the five traits that he concluded characterized wisdom. They were, first, reciprocity. I think by reciprocity, he not only refers to appreciating the give and take, but also foreseeing the many domino effects that an action or lack of action can have. His second trait is non-attachment. This is the ability to step back and objectively see things with perspective. Indeed, I find perspective is the key to so many things, such as emotional healing, progress in psychotherapy, turning pain into humor, and solving most problems. Non-attachment is what enables us to let go of pain and self-interest so we can see things from a different viewpoint. His third trait is doubt. Doubt helps with perspective. Ironically, some of the leaders he admired were leaders of causes and seemed to have little doubt. To me, Abraham Lincoln comes to mind. He seemed like a president who had terrible problems with doubt, but still could be decisive. On the other hand, presidents such as Ronald Reagan and Lyndon Johnson seemed to show little doubt. Henry Alford's fourth trait is discretion. This involves using non-attachment and perspective to appreciate how actions affect others and trying to do things in a way that does the most good and as kindly and considerately as possible. His fifth trait is working for the common good. That's what distinguishes those who are bright and clever but merely acting in self-interest from those who are helping a larger cause. Why did Henry Alford zip through these five traits? Because his style and his contribution isn't an academic effort. But as he said, the takeaway for him is the power of biography. Baby steps. I always like to leave listeners with a baby step, a little tweak in their thinking or their behavior that helps advance our goal of living longer, healthier, and happier. When we were kids, we had heroes. We had Superman and Mickey Mantle and sports heroes and Nancy Drew. As adults, most of us give up our heroes, with the possible exception of baseball and football heroes. But we very much need heroes as adults as well. The baby step today is to make a list of the five wisest people, in your opinion, who you know or know of. Hopefully your list includes some old people. Then consider what you would like to model in their thinking and in their actions. You're listening to Ageless Lifestyles on webtalkradio.net and permanently archived on agelesslifestyles.com. For information on my books, Defy Aging and 52 Baby Steps to Grow Young, my anti-aging hypnosis CDs, personal coaching, and my keynote and seminar services, just go to notaging.com, notaging.com, or drbrickey.com, drbrickey.com. This is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricky, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.